Radio Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, we'll get the latest news from the Times Union, from Republican pushback on a New York State dairy bill to lawn mowing goats maintaining one of the Hudson Valley's most prominent bridges. Philip Pantuso has those stories and more and joins me coming up. It's also National Gun Storage Safety Week. We talked to one of the folks spreading the word about avoiding tragic accidents through proper gun storage. We also have an update on the latest news from New York State, but first up, we have some news on a prominent local institution whose fate has been in serious flux this week, the Delaware Valley Job Corps. It's just the latest local institution to be impacted by shifting policies, practices, and priorities coming out of Washington, D.C. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has this report.
On Wednesday, the U.S. District Court for New York Southern District temporarily blocked the Trump administration's effort to suspend Job Corps centers that would have included seven centers across New York State, including the Delaware Valley Job Corps Center in Calicoon. Last week, the U.S. Labor Department announced it would pause operations at 99 Job Corps centers by the end of June as part of Trump's efforts to shrink the federal workforce. A U.S. district judge has since issued a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction against any efforts to eliminate the Job Corps program without congressional authorization. New York District 19 Representative Josh Riley wrote in a social media post he was glad the court stepped in, adding that Job Corps is a lifeline for young people in upstate New York. Job Corps is the largest free residential education and job training program for young adults ages 16 to 24 in the U.S. The Delaware Valley Job Corps program in Sullivan County hosts 177 students and 101 workers, according to Laura Quigley, Commissioner for Sullivan County Division of Community Services. Here's Quigley at a county legislature meeting on June 5th, sharing the impact these cuts have already had on students and workers who thought the centers were closing.
Students have already left. They've been leaving in small groups because they were told they needed to be out by the 12th. There will be roughly about 20 students left that are homeless or are in a position where they cannot go back home. And those are the people that we're going to directly link up with Orange County and New York City.
Quigley says this has disrupted student and worker livelihoods, and that if the government wants to eliminate this program, it has to be done in an orderly manner.
You can't close this down in 30 days. It just doesn't happen that way. So I'm very glad for the restraining order. We'll see what happens.
The federal court ordered the Department of Labor to appear at a court hearing on June 17th. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly. Well, now we have a quick update from Albany by way of Brooklyn, where Governor Hochul's first Democratic primary challenger has hit the campaign trail and is now attacking her from the left. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado says Governor Hochul hasn't done enough to direct resources to working people. It's a clean break from his one-time ally and running mate. At a rally in Brooklyn, Delgado said Hochul's recent plan to send $2 billion in rebate checks to New Yorkers isn't a good use of money.
To paper over this broken system with half measures driven by the politics of the moment is not leadership.
Delgado spoke to about 60 people in the back lot of a church, including members of the activist groups New York Communities for Change and Citizen Action of New York. So far, no elected officials have supported his insurgent bid, and some responded to the announcement of his candidacy by backing Hochul. Hochul's campaign declined to comment. In Brooklyn, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Continuing with New York State news, let's now turn to legislative matters because a proposed bill to limit large-scale farming in New York is dividing lawmakers on opposite sides of the aisle and opposite ends of the state. The story is at TimesUnion.com. I spoke to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, earlier today.
So this bill, which is just a proposal at the moment, would limit... The goal of it anyway would be to limit what it calls large-scale farming. So right now, the bill would basically say that farms that have at least 700 dairy cows, 1,000 veal calves, or 2,500 pigs would not be able to get a permit from the state DEC if they exceed those limits. And that would be going forward. I think the legislation carves out an exemption for farms that already have permits. And the reason for doing this, the bill sponsors say, is to limit environmental impacts. The bill contends that larger farms take a toll on the environment, collectively producing billions of pounds of manure each year and releasing significant amounts of methane, which is one of the more potent greenhouse gases. They also sort of try to frame this as a way to protect small farmers, which they're sort of differentiating, or they're sort of equating small farmers with like family farms and saying that these larger farms are more industrialized or factory farms. And they cite a report that came out last year from the environmental advocacy group Food and Water Watch that said that some 43% of dairy farms have closed in New York over the last 5 years. And over that same five-year period, this was 2017 to 2021, sorry, is the period it looked at, the state saw a 21% increase in the number of factory farmed dairy cows. So the raw number of farms is going down, but the actual number of cows is going up, which means more cows per farm. But as you noted, this is getting a lot of pushback. And I think a lot of this really has to do with who is sponsoring the bill. So it is sponsored by State Senator Jabari Brisport of Brooklyn and Assemblywoman Linda Rosenthal of Manhattan. They're sponsoring the various versions of the bill. And its critics are saying that, what do you guys know about dairy farming? you know, the state has something like 3,000 individual dairy farms and more than 600,000 dairy cows. It's the fifth largest milk producer in the U.S. And not a single one of those cows resides in New York City. All of the dairy farms in the state are outside of New York City limits. And, you know, our reporter, Lucy Hodgman, who wrote the story, she spoke to a number of people in the state legislature, some of whom are current or former dairy farmers themselves, who say that this bill just sort of doesn't really understand the realities of dairy farming. And that while maybe some of its purported aims are noble, particularly trying to protect small family farms, this is not really the way to go about it.
Right, and I'm curious now: is this something that the noble intent takes another form? Is this part of the normal kind of getting a bill into shape, or is this thing going to wind up being DOA?
Hard to say. Like I said, it hasn't really advanced in either chamber at the moment, as far as I'm aware. You know, I would imagine that the two sponsors will probably try to get some upstate sponsors or at least co-sponsors on the bill as well. But we'll have to sort of keep an eye on it to see how well it progresses.
Now, a couple weeks ago, we reported on the indictment of the Chester Highway Superintendent charged with attempted murder, among with other alleged crimes. This took place on May 2nd, the incident that he's been indicted for. Now he's also been arraigned.
Yes, he was arraigned on Monday in Orange County Court. This follows his indictment, which, as you mentioned, came a couple of weeks ago. The indictment charges him with 13 different charges, including second-degree attempted murder and two counts of first-degree assault. There's also a couple of, like, criminal possession charges. And the only update here is that he was arraigned this week and he pleaded not guilty on all counts. He's also out right now after posting bail. So his next scheduled court appearance is on July 2nd, and that is sort of when we'll know some more in this case.
All right. And some unpleasant news that I saw the other day, and this is about a father and daughter from Ulster County who were missing, and now their remains have been found.
Yeah, really tragic story. Father-daughter Tim and Esther Keiderling, who are from Ulster Park area in Ulster County, they were hiking Mount Katahdin in Maine, which is, I think it's the highest point in Maine, and it's the northernmost point of the Appalachian Trail. Park rangers there began searching for them on Monday morning after finding their vehicle in the day-use parking lot. It clearly had been there at least one night before. Set off a fairly extensive search that included dogs, a helicopter with the thermal imaging device, more than 50 park personnel, and you know, they were able to find, that search only concluded when they were able to find their bodies. On Wednesday, the crews discovered Esther Keiderling's body. She was 28 years old. The previous day, they had discovered her father in a nearby area. Police have, at this point, have not released much information about what happened to them exactly, although Norma Shannick, who wrote the story for us, she did some further research about Mount Katahdin, where turns out reportedly more than 60 people had died there since 1933, which is when the park began tracking deaths. This is according to a 2018 book. Obviously, there's now at least a couple more who've died since then. And it's a pretty popular hike, being the northernmost part of the Appalachian Trail. So popular, in fact, that at least on some parts of the trail, hikers actually have to obtain a permit because the park rangers are limiting access.
Yeah, and the article ends with a quote from the daughter here who reportedly wrote, "I'm a little nervous after everything I've read about the Abel Trail, but I'm going to it if weather permits. If you don't see me back on Substack notes again, that's where I am." So it seems like they even had some knowledge of the reputation of this trail.
Yeah. Yeah. Really sad.
Yeah. But let's end on a slightly lighter note, because I heard that state bridge authorities have enlisted some help in maintaining a notable bridgeway, and that help comes on four legs.
Yeah. So visitors to the walkway over the Hudson State Park, one of the more popular tourist sites in the Hudson Valley, may spot, I love how Noir put this in our story, the quietest lawnmowers of the pedestrian bridge, which is a team of goats. So the Bridge Authority has hired a team of goats from a company called Green Goats of Rhinebeck, which offers what it calls goat grazing services to dozens of clients in upstate New York. Those include the Vanderbilt Mansion in Hyde Park and Bard College. The herd basically just, what they do is they do what goats do, which is graze. They're going to be removing poison ivy, weeds, and other overgrown vegetation from the grassy area beneath the walkway over the Hudson. They'll be there for most of June. And then they'll be back again for several weeks in September, according to a spokesperson for the Bridge Authority. And this is not just a cute story. There actually is like real reasons for using goats. They allow maintenance workers to focus on other jobs. They are, of course, more or less environmentally harmful than chemical weed killers or lawn mowing machines, many of which can be pretty polluting. But yeah, if you go to the walkway anytime this June, you're probably going to see some goats, which is just another good reason to go spend some time up there.
One more thing to see up there. All these stories we've been talking about are at timesunion.com. You got all the goats that are fit to print there. TimesUnion.com. We're talking to Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley Times Union. Thank you so much, Philip.
You got it. Take care.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. This week is Gun Storage Check Week, observed nationwide from June 1st to 7th. Led by the National Shooting Sports Foundation, or NSSF, the initiative promotes safe firearm storage to help prevent tragic accidents. Timmy O, CEO of Vera Safety, has been a strong advocate for responsible gun ownership. His company has developed innovative gun storage solutions in support of the cause. Annie Bennett, one of Radio Catskill's new reporters, spoke with Timmy O recently to learn more.
Gun Storage Check Week is a program that has been organized by the Project Child Safe and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is one of the largest organizations in the gun industry. This initiative really is to help promote and let gun owners know about the importance of securing your firearms. So it's been a huge privilege to work together with them. We're a company that started here in upstate New York from RPI to create a technology to enhance and improve firearm safety and security.
Why is this necessary? Why do we need a gun storage check week?
So the main importance is a lot of gun owners own a firearm to be able to protect themselves, and they need fast access to it. At the same time, there's this general idea where a lot of these gun owners put their firearms in a place such as like on top of their fridge or in their nightstand. But that in itself has been proven not to be actually secure enough, where children get access to these firearms or intruders are able to easily access it if they do break into a home. So this program really is a initiative from the actual gun industry to help promote responsibility in that use.
So I want to talk about you for a bit, if that's all right. You grew up with an uncle in the LAPD. You've been interacting with guns from a young age. How do you think that sort of shaped you and your involvement in this?
Having an uncle in the LAPD made me kind of realize the pain point that a lot of gun owners feel, where, like, as a police officer, of course, they are highly trained in how to be safe with a firearm. However, when I went over to the LAPD and actually got to speak with a lot of police officers, there was this issue where they still wanted to keep their home protection firearm close and nearby, and more likely than not unsecured, because they thought it'd be too slow to access it in an emergency. So that's how that journey started into creating a product like that for gun owners.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've always kind of been skeptical about guns, because to me, it always seems like you either have a dangerous weapon lying around, or in order to keep it safe, you lock it up to the point where it wouldn't actually serve the purpose of needing it in an emergency.
So our product is almost like a hybrid between a holster and a safe. And so the handle of the firearm is visible. And when you reach out and grab it, your thumb goes onto a biometric sensor on the safe or holster, and it unlocks within 0.2 seconds. So it's one of the fastest locking devices on the market, but designed in a way where it's extremely secure, and you could literally mount it next to your nightstand, next to your bed. Some people even mount it in their vehicle.
So take me back, right? You're 17 years old when you start, you know, trying to address this problem. You're trying to create a gun safety product as a teenager. What was that journey like?
It was pretty phenomenal in the whole fact that how encouraging that gun owners, gun stores, and the overall industry was. Because of my age, I just kind of felt like a kid going into this huge problem trying to solve. Everyone was so welcoming when they kind of found out what I was trying to do, gave me feedback. And then just a year or two down the line too, I would have never imagined being invited out to like conferences or meeting people from the National Shooting Sports Foundation.
That's pretty impressive. So I guess with the tagline of Gun Storage Check Week is make sure it's secure. What actually counts as secure?
It's requires some form of authentication. That's one of the core messages of the Gun Safety Check Week, is that just hiding it or keeping it out of reach it's not enough because it's always easy for especially children to be able to explore and find these places. So rather having it in a method that needs some form of authentication, whether it be a key, keypad, or biometric, I think is the most important step on that checklist. So there's a variety of options for keeping a firearm secure. This goes from just like these simple devices that are affordable or even given out for free, such as cable locks. I think the most common and widely known method is a lockbox or a safe. So there's like a pretty broad spectrum of security devices available for safe storage.
What role do you see the government playing in some of these regulations? I mean, New York and the United States have very specific legislation surrounding gun safety and concealed carry, things like that. Should we be pushing for legislation to require better gun safety practices?
I know a lot of states such as New York and California, where I was originally from, have definitely been using legislation to push it. I think, especially with the industry, though, and the demographic of the gun industry of where gun control is always a concern, I think this is kind of what I really appreciated about this NSSF program, where it's completely voluntary. It's more about education and gun owners recommending what's the best practices to each other. And I think that's definitely my preferred method as well. Something that is more acceptable for most of the demographic of gun owners in terms of how a certain idea is presented to them.
That makes sense. I mean, if gun control is like a big trigger point, you know, people are less likely to follow. If, you know, this is such a big problem as organizations like Project Safe and the NSFF are putting out, then wouldn't it make sense to have some sort of requirement around it rather than just it being voluntary?
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest part is how people react to what's presented to them, right? So if you're presented with like a hard requirement, especially in this political climate where everything's so polarized, I think even if the message is something where an individual may inherently agree with, such as safe gun storage practices, if it's presented in the wrong manner or kind of put out there as a mandate, I think there becomes this visceral reaction to just reject it, despite what the topic or what they might inherently feel, just as a response to their politics or because it's from the government, I think, which is really unfortunate. But that's kind of the reality we live in today. You could disagree about what might be more effective or what might not be. But I think just in terms of what's accepted by most people, keeping it voluntary and keeping it the messaging coming from people that they trust becomes very effective.
With that divide that, you know, we're identifying about people not responding well to anything coming from the government, but also it being a serious problem that we're trying to regulate. Do you have any insight on sort of how to bridge that gap?
Yeah, I do have one thought in that regards. I think it's just the exposure to the solutions that are out there is a really great approach. So when these organizations such as the NSSF, and there's a bunch of innovative gun safe companies out there as well, partner and get those messaging out there, that's when people are able to access this information and say, hey, that might be a product that I would actually use.
And yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I know that less than half of gun owners report safely controlling their weapons, which is definitely a problem that, you know, education could hopefully help address.
I think the main educational points are just emphasizing the fact again that just keeping it out of sight or out of reach in itself is not enough. Letting them know there's better solutions and better methods to actually secure your firearm. There's so many ways to be able to quickly access your firearm and balance those two values of protecting your family, but also keeping your family and others secure. I think that balance point is something that everyone can find a solution to. It's just a matter of doing the research and finding out which potential products might be most effective for them.
Thank you so much for talking with me and being here and everything.
Yep, of course, likewise. Thank you so much.
From Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Annie, for that interview. Before we go tonight, we have a quick story about water, because New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation is developing a new framework to help municipalities keep drinking water clean in New York State. WAMC's Samantha Simmons reports.
Streams, reservoirs, and other bodies that provide drinking water to local communities can often be contaminated before a municipal treatment plant makes the water safe for consumption. Think runoff from agriculture or salt on the road that seeps into the groundwater. But since 2021, the DEC and other state agencies have been working with local municipalities across the state to develop best practices for how to limit that contamination. The DEC's Drinking Water Source Protection Program Framework 2025 is now available for public comment, the final step before the framework becomes an established program. While the 104 participating municipalities have been leading their local conversations around the development of these strategies, DEC, the State Department of Health, and the State Department of Agriculture and Markets have provided support. The aim is to assist communities with building and implementing a protection program for their water, including privately operated community public water systems. The framework builds on the pre-existing Source Water Assessment Program, or SWAP, which promotes plans that are locally developed, implemented, and maintained. The program is designed to support all public water supplies, especially those that have limited staff capacity. Ryan Bell is the program manager for the DOH. He says the idea is to protect water before it gets to a treatment plant to reduce the risk of contamination.
The quality and safety of our drinking water is impacted by how we use the land surrounding the source. Potential sources of contamination can come from both point and non-point sources. So some examples, as you can see, include solid waste management facilities, agriculture, runoff from roadways, and salt application, as well as residential sources, which may include failing septic systems or lawn and garden chemicals.
Bell says municipalities can be proactive by conserving land, develop zoning that includes source water protection, and educate the community. Since the program's launch, officials say it has been successful and reaches more than 2.5 million consumers statewide. Once finalized, current source water conditions will be evaluated based on data and mapping. Once that's completed, actionable steps will be shared with municipalities. A new library of funding sources is one of several additions to the program, according to Kristen Martinez, an environmental program specialist with the DEC's Division of Water.
It is a library of over 100 federal, state, and local funding sources that anyone can filter down using criteria, for example, applicant type, project type, to then narrow down funding sources for their specific project.
Municipalities will be offered free technical assistance through the development process and the start of implementation, a flexible schedule, inventory of potential contaminants surrounding the source, and guidance on funding sources. The public comment period runs through June 25th. Samantha Simmons, WAMC News.
Well, that's it for the local edition. Thank you so much for being here tonight. Hey, don't forget, NEPA Gives starts tonight and it ends tomorrow night. It's just 24 hours long. One day of giving to support nonprofits doing good work in Northeast PA. Nonprofits like Radio Catskill. You can support the good work that we do that benefits Northeastern Pennsylvania. We've got a goal of $2,500 that we're trying to raise during this one-day event. The donation portal opens up in just half an hour. NEPA Gives goes from 7 tonight until 7 tomorrow night. Go to nepagives.org for more info. That's nepagives.org to support Radio Catskill. Also, don't forget, when you get a chance, go check out protectmypublicmedia.org as well. Find more ways to help Radio Catskill there. protectmypublicmedia.org. Well, I'm Jason Dole, and that's it for me. The Daily's up next. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Thane Peterson. Join me for great music from the newest artists with a little bit of classic jazz from the greats of the past thrown into the mix. Living Jazz, Saturday at noon, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.